Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, December 5th, and I'm your host, Kara Santamaria. So we're approaching the holidays now, and because of that, I want to do things a little bit differently here at the top of the show. I will let you know that my guest this week is an incredible author. Her recent book is called The Glass Universe: How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. She is Deva Sobel, and we will be chatting with her in just a bit. But before we do, I wanted to let you know that I have partnered up once again this year with GeekWrapped.com, and we're doing a really cool holiday science gift giveaway. So what you're going to want to do is go to geekwrapped.com/talknerdy, and there you'll see the giveaway page. You are entering for a chance to win an incredibly cool set of galaxy printed bed sheets. They're really beautiful, and they'll be sent to you in the size that you need for your bed. So what you're going to want to do is go to that website, geekwrapped.com/talknerdy, and you can enter to win in a bunch of different ways. I've curated a super cool set of gift ideas for the holidays that I love and I think you might love or somebody in your geeky circle might love. So I wanted to go through them with you before we dive into the podcast. Obviously, the first is those incredible galaxy bed sheets that we're giving away. They're beautiful and they're so freaking cool, and I want them for my own bedroom. The next is a 3D printing pen. So instead of the large 3D printer that you would have in your house, it's an individual pen that uses the extrusion plastic so that you can do all sorts of cool creative arts basically by painting in three dimensions. It's just incredible. I've also listed Snadums on the site. And if those of you who know Veritasium, my friend Derek Muller, the YouTuber, he invented this really cool magnetic molecular modeling kit that lets you much better model a sugar molecule, and then you can do add-ons to make even more things than just glucose. They're incredible. They're a lot of fun, and they're for sale now. So I've added Snadums to my holiday gift list. Also, we've got a cell phone charging case that comes in almost every size imaginable that has a crank on the back. So cool. So you've experienced this, I know, because I experience it all the time. You're out someplace where you are running low on battery and you don't have access to your charger because you either forgot it or you're not in a car, and there's just no easy way for you to get juice, but you need it to call that Uber or to text your friend. This battery case allows you to hand crank it to get enough juice to be able to make that call. Genius. I've also added to the gift guide the Dinosphere. If you guys don't know anything about the Dinospheres by Biopop, I have one. I am obsessed with it. It's a little kind of terrarium full of liquid. So by day, it looks just like there's water in it. But by night, if you give it a little shake, it actually lights up because it's full of bioluminescent phytoplankton. They're called dinoflagellates. That's where the Dinosphere comes in. And they glow this beautiful blue-green, and it makes the coolest gift, the best little nightlight, and it's totally affordable. And then lastly, I've included in the gift guide the Augmented Reality Planetarium. It's super cool. You plug your smartphone into this viewer, this basically headset, and you can look through it at the real night sky looking up with superimposed digital information. So it turns the outside into an incredible augmented reality planetarium. Absolutely cool. I recommend any of these amazing gifts or anything else really on geekwrapped.com. He has incredible geek guides for you to look through if you're a big fan of science like I am and like I know you are. So visit the site one more time, geekwrapped.com/talknerdy, for your chance to win. All right, just a tiny bit more business. I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week by pledging your support through Patreon or PayPal. We have a couple of big supporters on PayPal this week, so I want to thank David R. Hepburn and Diane Adams for your support. And then over on the Patreon portal, blah, so many P's, very alliterative. Remember that you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy or just visit my website, karasantamaria.com, and click through to the links to pledge your support. support. I want to thank Phil Tiber, Timothy Glover, David Laser, welcome to the group, Jeffrey Perez, Ron K. Noblock, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Stuart Ogg, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. You guys, you're so incredible. You make Talk Nerdy possible each and every week. Okay, without any further ado. I got an email from somebody saying that it was annoying. No, it was in my feedback that it's annoying that I always say without any further ado. So I'm going to retract that burp and say, without taking up any more time, let's jump into the episode. Dava Sobel is an incredible science writer, and she's written for like every outlet you can imagine, including the New York Times, the New Yorker. She had a staff position at Cornell. I mean, gosh, she's just incredible. And she's written a whole bunch of books. You may have read Longitude or Galileo's Daughter or The Planets, and The Sun Stood Still, Even a More Perfect Heaven. But her newest book is very near and dear to my heart. It's absolutely special. It's called The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And you know what? I'm just going to dive right in and let her tell you all about it. Here she is, Dava Sobel. Well, Dava, thank you so much for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
I am very excited about your newest book, just so that I can get the full title in, The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. This seems to be a popular theme lately, doesn't it? Kind of rediscovering some of the untold stories of women in early science.
Yes, it does. I did not expect my book to be the third book this year about women who worked as computers. But my ladies are different from the ladies in The Rise of the Rocket Girls or Hidden Figures, because they weren't just computers. They were really astronomers.
And so when we talk about human computers, you know, it really is a funny title to many of my listeners who might have grown up with computers, thinking about a person being a computer. But that was a common title that was given kind of in the early to mid-1900s, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Observatories always had computers to do the math, and they were real people. The machines should really have a different name.
I think at the beginning, they actually did refer to them as non-human computers to make that distinction. But then, of course, Exactly. And once they were more trustworthy, of course, and people were more comfortable kind of relying on their calculations, many of the human computers moved on to become computer programmers or to become engineers in other respects. Right. But your ladies are very different. You know, when we think about the women in Hidden Figures and Rise of the Rocket Girls, we're talking about sort of mid-century women who often were African-American and were hired because of labor shortages during the war. Your ladies that you feature in this book were working long before the middle of the 20th century.
That's right. They started in the 1870s.
Wow. And we generally don't think of women as holding jobs, first of all, and definitely not jobs that were kind of out of the, quote, domestic arts that early in time.
No, it really surprises people.
And so what kinds of positions? Many of these women were working as human computers. They were working at the Harvard Observatory. What kinds of jobs were they given? At the beginning, were they just doing calculations?
Yes. And at the beginning, they were really roped into the work through family ties. So the wives, sisters, daughters of the astronomers learned how to do what was necessary and just did it. But at Harvard, starting in the 1870s, outside women were also hired, not just the family members. And that was a little unusual. That was part of the forward-thinking, open-mindedness of the director.
Interesting. So it really was very Harvard-specific. It wasn't a sort of shift in the American viewpoint of who should be working in these observatories.
No, it was definitely a Harvard phenomenon, which I find so ironic because Harvard University really is not a place you think of when you think of where did women gain an early toehold in science. And the reason it happened there was that the observatory, although it was affiliated and it was called the Harvard College Observatory, it really was a wholly separate entity. It relied on its own funding. The staff at the observatory was not part of the faculty of the college. So they were separate, and they did things their own way. And hiring women and promoting them to positions of importance was very much a feature of the observatory, not the university.
Ah, interesting. And so I'd love to kind of take a step back before we dive into these wonderful stories and ask you personally what it was about this historical time, what it was about these women that captured your imagination so and made you want to write this book.
The first inkling I had about this story came from astronomer Wendy Friedman. I was interviewing her, this must have been 20 or 25 years ago, when she was in charge of one of the Hubble telescope key projects for determining the expansion rate of the universe. And she mentioned the name Henrietta Swan Leavitt, a person who lived from the late 19th to early 20th century. She died in 1921. And this woman had made a discovery that made it possible to measure distances in deep space. You know, of course, when you look up at the sky, you really have no way of telling what's near, what's far. And for a long time, no one had a way. Mm-hmm. That discovery was pivotal. And so the fact that a highly placed woman astronomer was mentioning a woman from long ago who had made a fundamental discovery towards research that is ongoing today, that definitely got my attention. And when I went to look at Miss Leavitt, I discovered she worked in a room full of women, and they were all doing various research projects that were all really important.
And of course, this story is not the first story that you've told in text. You have been a science writer for quite a long time.
Yes. Yes, I have. And it's been my pleasure and good fortune to be able to tell several really engrossing stories that were completely engaging for me to research and write.
I do notice a theme in a lot of your writing, I would say more your book writing than some of your freelance work or your staff work, that you do tend to focus on astronomy, and you do tend to focus on astronomy with a strong kind of historical bent to it.
Yes, that's what I'm most interested in.
So that is a kind of a personal choice. It's just when you are doing your research and following, you know, the leads that most interest you, that's where your mind goes.
Yes, and it's surprising to me because when I was a student, I didn't think I was interested in history at all. And it's become something I enjoy to a great degree.
Did you always know that you were interested in science?
Yes, I was always interested in science, and I was always interested in writing. I just didn't know that you could put them together. When I was in school, in high school and college in the 1960s, science writing was not really a popular designated career choice. Mm. And I just didn't think there was a union. I thought it would be a choice. And I was happy to discover at my first newspaper job that I could actually write about science. And I've been doing more or less the same thing ever since.
And you've written for, you know, some major outlets throughout your career. You've worked at universities. You've also worked at the New York Times. And of course, as a freelancer, you've contributed pieces to Wow, The New Yorker, Audubon, Discover, Science Digest, many, many popular science outlets. Did you enjoy your time more when you were on staff or when you were doing your freelance work?
I enjoy the freelance work more. I used to say, after you've said you're a reporter for the New York Times, it's all downhill from there. It's really a very high-pressure situation. Mm-hmm. The deadlines, the attention that comes to a person writing for that publication. And at the time, I was assigned to a beat. Almost everyone in the science news department had a particular beat. And I was given the beat of psychiatry and psychology, for which I was not really well prepared. Mm. So I was spending every spare moment giving myself a graduate course in those topics. So I found the whole experience stressful. And then some of the assignments I got were their own stressful experiences, such as being volunteered as a human subject in a research project that involved living inside a laboratory for a month without ever knowing what time it was.
Oh, no. Oh, how interesting. So they were looking at your circadian rhythm.
Exactly.
Was it fun or was it just wholly frustrating and kind of stressful?
It was unique. It was not fun because it was a medical study. So there was a lot of blood testing, urine collecting, you name it. I was a guinea pig. Mm-hmm. And so, no, it wasn't fun. But at the same time, it was such an unusual experience. And as a person interested in science, I, of course, loved the fact that I was becoming a data point. Mm-hmm. That was perversely appealing to me.
I love that. And so obviously you've been your own data point, but with many of your long form works, your books, you focused on data points that are mostly in the heavens. And so coming back to your newest book, The Glass Universe, what does that title refer to?
It refers to a collection of glass photographic plates, very beautiful objects, 500,000 strong, that are still archived at the Harvard College Observatory and are still used. So this was a photography project begun in the 1880s by the then director, Edward Pickering, and it was continued for 100 years. So it's a record of the night sky, both hemispheres. On many nights, the pictures were taken all through the night. And those pictures enabled a large group of women to make a series of stunning discoveries. And so the book is about the plate collection, but more about the humans who used the plates.
So these glass plates were kind of an early form of some of the computational data that astronomers can now get. So the telescopes oftentimes now are computerized or at least connected to some sort of data collection device, and they're able to then go through these files and make really, really precise measurements. But back then, they were really just taking photos. They were taking photos of the capturing of the night sky and sort of, I guess, developing them on glass.
Right. And so the photos were of several types. There were certainly pictures of the heavens as a way to determine which stars were where. That was very important for navigation. But there were also pictures that were taken not only through the telescope, but through a prism. So the starlight was spread out into spectra. And from the patterns in the spectra, the women were able to develop a system for classifying the stars.
So this was some of the earliest spectrophotometry.
Exactly.
And being able to look at the spectra of stars, meaning, you know, the rainbows, I guess you could say, that they put off.
And rainbows in black and white.
Rainbows in black and white, exactly. You're able to, you know, through a lot of kind of genius thoughts and calculations, determine some of the chemicals that those stars are actually putting off.
Yes, by looking at the patterns of lines in the spectra, it was possible to identify particular chemicals. But it was also a question of looking at the overall pattern of the lines and trying to envision groups of stars. And at the time, there was also a sense that those patterns might mean any number of things, not just chemical content, but temperature, evolutionary stage in the life of a star. Nobody really knew at the beginning. It was very much a personal judgment. Okay, I'll start with this pattern, these prominent lines, and I'll call these group A. And then if the lines look a little different, I'll call those group B, and we'll see how far we get.
Wow. So you know, the quantitative techniques were being developed, but what those quantifications, I guess you could say, what those actual numbers meant, what the spectra referred to, was sort of a detective game at that point.
Yeah, it was still open what the significance would be.
How fun. I mean, how probably incredibly painstaking and oftentimes very frustrating, but how wonderful to be on the brink of such major discoveries.
Yes. And the women who took these jobs really loved what they were doing. They knew how important it was. They knew the opportunity that had been offered them, and they ran with it.
So even though they were hired as human computers, in essence, they really were working as astronomers and astrophysicists.
Yes. And their work attracted a lot of attention. So one of the women, early on in 1899, she was named the curator of these glass photographs. And the curator position was considered an office in the university, not just the observatory. So she was the first woman to have a Harvard University title,
Wow. Which
was a landmark event.
Did they face a lot of resistance within Harvard itself?
Well, they didn't have to deal with Harvard itself too much. Mm. Mostly the director was the buffer. He went to the university. And at that time, for that appointment, the president of Harvard, who was Charles Eliot, went along pretty much with whatever the director said. Later, when Eliot was replaced by Abbott Lowell, there was a different attitude about women. And even the successor to the first one's title, it was suddenly no longer a university position, but just became a matter of observatory business. So their fortunes rose and fell with the attitude of the university administration. But at the same time, the money for the projects, again, the observatory was responsible for raising its own funds. So the money for this enormous photography project came from a wealthy widow whose husband had been an avid amateur astronomer. She had been his assistant. And just when he got his affairs in order so he could devote himself full time to this work, he died. And she was not only heartbroken, but frustrated that this work wasn't going to be done. And so she gave Harvard the money to do the work. And it was a lot of money every year. She gave them more than their annual budget every year. And then she left them some more money in her will.
Wow. So not only was the work done by women, it was financed by women as well.
Yes. And then another woman came along and just wrote them a check for $50,000 to build a big telescope in the Southern Hemisphere. Because if you want to really capture the night sky, you You have to do it from both hemispheres.
Wow. So I'm looking at some of the beautiful plates that are printed in the middle of the book with, you know, some images and some early kind of hand calculations. And there's a couple of wonderful portraits of the female staff at the time. I don't know much historically about dress or about culture or about kind of societal ranking. But looking at these images, I'm wondering, were these women mostly society types, or were they poorer women, or did they come from all walks of life?
They were certainly not society types. Those were the donors. Mm-hmm. The women who gave money were at the peak of New York society. But working in the observatory, many of them were working because they had to. The one I mentioned earlier, who was the first woman to hold a title at Harvard, she was a Scottish immigrant. She had originally been hired as a maid, but the director realized how intelligent she was and put her to work in the observatory. And she helped develop the classification system. Her name was Wilhelmina Fleming. And others who came in were people who had held secretarial jobs in Boston, in and around Boston. But starting in the 1880s, the new women's colleges provided a stream of qualified graduates who really had a background in astronomy. They weren't just good at math and ready to learn something new. They knew how to use a telescope. So the director was happy to have them. And that created a change. And then people on staff at the observatory began offering practical astronomy courses at Radcliffe. So women could come and study, and then the promising students could be offered jobs in the observatory.
Isn't it funny how sometimes with progress, especially when we're talking about gender equality, ethnic equality, there's sort of a two steps forward, three steps back theme that we often see, where certain groups of people will be embracing, will be forward thinking, but then institutions are sometimes a little bit behind, or a certain institution is forward thinking, but there's still resistance in other aspects of society. When we think about training opportunities for these women, I can only imagine that many women actually went to school. You know, they faced these intense odds. They were able to go to school, even get some degrees, only to not face many open positions within the workforce.
That's true. And what's also true at that period is the whole question of higher education for women was very controversial. A book came out that claimed that higher education was actually damaging to women and could perhaps interfere with childbearing.
Oh my God.
Which, if you can believe that. So the director, again, Edward Pickering, was so open-minded because he was all in favor of higher education for women. Before he took over at Harvard, he had been a physics teacher at MIT, and he allowed women into his class. Women weren't formally registered as students at MIT, but if someone approached him and said, "I'd really like to take your physics class," he would say yes. And so when his projects needed more help than he could afford to hire, he advertised broadly for volunteers, and he especially appealed to the graduates of women's colleges who had this kind of background but had no professional outlet for their abilities. Mm. And he said not only would the observatory be happy to have their observations and would publish them, but by doing this kind of work, they could help show the world that higher education for women was a good thing.
And I can only imagine how difficult it was for those women themselves. You know, some of them may have had the kind of constitution or the, you know, good fortune to have supportive families, supportive husbands, or maybe they were single and they were able to make these kinds of decisions on their own. But I'm sure many of these women, not only did they face pressures in their personal lives that, you know, made it more difficult for them to pursue that education and then that career path, but they also probably were less prepared academically. Because even if they had the good fortune to go to college, they didn't have all of the college prep that many of the men had, because just societally, it wasn't expected that women were supposed to get this education.
That's true. And I wouldn't say that the history of the women's colleges was my strong area, but I think the colleges understood and provided the prep and the college education. And the faculty at those institutions was mindful of all the criticism, and and people were intent on turning out graduates who they could be proud of.
Absolutely. And these women oftentimes had to, you know, travel in order. It wasn't like now where you can kind of just go to the local university. You know, there were so few options for training for these women. They had to really want it because they had to make some sort of life-changing decisions to do it. But some of these women at the Harvard Observatory, at least early on, didn't even have college degrees. They were, you know, they were hired in a lot of different kind of positions and only then sort of nurtured and taught how to do these calculations and how to do some of these astronomical observations.
Yes, most of them had just a high school education.
Do you think that they themselves were surprised by the opportunities that opened up to them? You know, do you think that they expected, you know, oh, I'm just going to get a secretarial job like, you know, many of my friends do, and then they realized very quickly that this was something special?
I think anybody who applied at the observatory knew that it was special, that it was unusual, that the work would not be routine, would not be something they could do anywhere else. And once there, they stayed. People worked 30, 40, 50 years at these jobs. And I think you mentioned supportive husbands before, but at that time, if you got married, you didn't work anymore. So these were people who really were married to the job.
Interesting. So these were many women who either didn't have husbands or were widowed or for whatever reason were able to focus full time on their jobs.
Right. And needed a job.
Because maybe they were trying to raise children or helping out their aging parents or for whatever reason they needed the income.
Yes.
Why do you think it is that many of these women are, in essence, lost to history? Why are they not the names that are on the tips of people's tongues when asked, who's the greatest astronomer or who's an interesting scientific figure?
I think people lose lots of names to history. Just there are so many names in history. We don't keep them all at the front of our thoughts. These women perhaps deserve better than they've had, but astronomers always know the names. This story is known, at least in a skeletal form, to anybody who has studied astronomy at all. In fact, the recent remake of Cosmos, Carl Sagan's Cosmos, which was redone a couple of years ago with Neil deGrasse Tyson as the host, and in the revised version, one of the episodes was devoted to the Harvard College women. It was called Sisters of the Sun. And that got attention from a lot of young women who started doing their own projects about them. So there have been a couple of plays, their artworks, an art exhibition is being done that will open next spring, based on the plates and the women who worked with them. So I think their day is dawning. It's very exciting.
I would agree. You know, I have a dear friend named Holly Bender. She's been on the show previously, and she does optics at NASA, at JPL, here in the Los Angeles area. She's an optics engineer. And we call her the mistress of space rainbows. when she was first gaining that interest back growing up in New York, she did, I think, a summer program that was an all-girl summer program in astronomy and physics. And that's where her love was kindled. And I, you know, didn't ask her specifically at the time, but I would not be surprised if some of these incredible figures weren't introduced to those women at the time and really did inspire them to follow this path. I think many female astronomers can point to some of these stories as being pivotal for their own development in physics.
Well, I have two thoughts on that. Do you remember if Holly Bender mentioned Nantucket? Is that where she took the course?
I'm not sure where it was. I would have assumed that it was in New York, but she may have traveled for it.
Okay. But in terms of having these women as role models, I asked one of the current female astronomy professors at Harvard to be one of the people who would read my book as a technical expert when it was still in manuscript. Mm-hmm. And her reaction surprised me so, because what she really responded to was the fact that the women had been doing real science. And she said, I've heard these names, I knew they worked here, but I always thought it was something cute or quaint. It was never clear to me that they were really working. And this same modern astronomer had been offered a prize. There's an Annie Jump Cannon prize named for the woman who classified 500,000 stars for the Harvard classification. And it's still given. It's given every year now. Mm-hmm. So this female faculty member at Harvard had been offered that prize, and she refused it because she didn't want any prize that was just for women.
Wow.
So I said, well, now that you know who Annie Jump Cannon was, are you sorry? You said no. And people are thinking of changing the prize to just be for a young astronomer, to remove that sense that many people have that, you know, if it's for women, it's second class.
Interesting. But I would assume that the reason that there is still a prize for women is because we are still living in a world where gender equality has not been fully achieved because of the historical disenfranchisement of women, especially in these higher educational atmospheres. There is still a need for specialized prizes like that. But I do think that many people don't see it that way. There's kind of just this assumption that, oh, that was a long time ago. Things were different then. Everything's equal for everyone now, which is, I think, very short-sighted.
I think we're not really there yet.
No.
And that's another reason I like the title, The Glass Universe, because it summons the glass ceiling.
Absolutely.
The universe is a kind of ceiling over all of us, but that was intentional.
So you have, you know, dabbled in this, you know, sort of in this area in the past because you wrote a book about Galileo's daughter. You've, you know, focused on strong
but that
women.
Was very different because Galileo's daughter was in no sense a scientist. Mm. What was interesting to me about her was the fact that she was a nun. And people tend to think, or I had been taught to think of Galileo as an enemy of the church.
Yeah.
And so when I learned he had two daughters who were nuns, I thought, they taught me something that doesn't sound right here. And so that was the impetus for that book. And yes, she was strong. She was a wonderful writer and a very good and interesting person, but not a scientist.
And it's interesting that when you focus on strong women, and especially, I should say, shifting back to this book, scientific women, there is inherent in telling that story a feministic quality. Do you find that when reviewers have read your book, or when sort of the general media, or even just the public, you know, in social media, have had an opportunity maybe to get advanced copies or to read about the upcoming release, that you get any backlash, or that it becomes a much more politicized conversation than you intended?
No, that hasn't happened at all. I think partly because it's really not a chip on the shoulder story. Mm-hmm. These women were given a great chance, and they got worldwide recognition for what they did in their own lifetimes. They were, two of them were made foreign associate members of the Royal Astronomical Society. They got honorary degrees. So there was no sense of, gee, I'm toiling away here and I'm earning nothing and nobody's paying attention to me. No, it wasn't like that at all. And as the years went by and the women's program at Harvard became a model for an educational program for the university, all the early graduate students had to be women because the only funding available was for women. And so the first Harvard PhD in astronomy was a woman. And she went on to become a full professor and chair of the department. So again, it's not a chip on the shoulder story.
Wow, I had no idea. That's fascinating.
Yeah, the education part was the biggest surprise to me in the course of research. You never know what you'll find when you start out. But after Pickering died in 1919 and a new young director took over, his name was Harlow Shapley, he really wanted to have a program in graduate astronomy education, graduate level program. And the only money the observatory controlled for bringing in students was a fellowship for women that had been contributed by another wealthy person interested in the women's work at Harvard. So he looked for graduate students from the women's colleges. And it was another 3 years before he could also have money to bring in male students. But by then, the first PhD had gone to Cecilia Payne.
That's so interesting. It kind of blows my mind that it just sort of happened to be that way, you know?
Yeah.
It sounds like that really kind of caught you off guard as well when you were digging through some of the research.
Yes, it did.
So I have to ask, you know, you, first of all, what did you study in school? Were you always into journalism? Was that kind of your first love?
No, I was never a journalism student. I didn't even read the newspaper when I was in school. So I always say life is just a long experience and on-the-job training. So, but I was, as I said, I always loved to write. But what I loved to write were term papers. Mm-hmm. And people sometimes say to me, I would hate your job. It's like writing one college term paper after another. And I say, yes, that suits me just fine. So in answer to the question, what did I study? I studied everything because since I didn't know how to put science and writing together, which seems so stupid now, but I was an English major for a while. I was a science major. I was a theater major. My degree is actually in theater history. But then I got a newspaper job and was writing about science at the newspaper. And that redirected my course happily.
When you first started in the newspaper business, were there many other women on the science desk as well? Was it a pretty mixed bag or were you, that's actually not the right phrase there. Was it a pretty mixed room or
well,
were
when
you?
I started at the newspaper. I started writing for the Binghamton Evening and Sunday Press. And so I was hired on the women's pages. They didn't have a science desk. And that was a good thing because I had great freedom in the choice of my feature stories. And it was 1970. So it was the year of the first Earth Day. And I started writing about conservation, pollution, genetic counseling was just coming into being. I wrote about that. And it was science writing, but I still hadn't heard that term.
That's so cool. Did you find when you were sort of making your way and learning to be a science reporter before you kind of knew what a science reporter was, did you find that there were any parallels with the women in your story? Or, you know, when you approached The Glass Universe, was it really just as a sort of objective observer, or did you feel that there were some parallels within any of your own experiences as you studied these women?
I was just interested in the women's story of that period. I was really very fortunate in not encountering any kind of prejudice as I came up through various jobs. And I know that's unusual. At my age, I'm 69, so I'm of an age where I should have encountered all sorts of roadblocks, but I just didn't. So I wasn't really looking for a feminist story. I just knew about these women, and I knew that this was a great story. Before anybody starts to tell it, it just has all those marks. It's unusual. They were on the dawning of modern astrophysics. The things they did have had value that is still of value today. So everything about it is interesting, surprising. And it was just a question of how much could I actually learn about them as characters so the story would be something a reader could follow. It wouldn't be just a lot of names and a lot of scientific concepts, but it would really be a story.
And that's what you are so good at, and I can tell you are so passionate about, is narrative nonfiction. You know, writing in such a way that we as the reader can be learning about science and learning about history, but it really is just reading a book, you know, reading a wonderful tale.
Thank you. Yeah, if people sometimes refer to Longitude as a novel, and I take it as a compliment.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, that is such a high compliment that in telling truth that somebody, you know, notes that it's such a page turner and they can't wait to see what happens next. Do you think that science should always be told in this way? Would you like to see more journalists kind of learn and practice good storytelling in their science communication?
Well, I think they do. And I think there are many kinds of science writing. And I think scientists themselves are under a lot of pressure to be storytellers. And that's not always the right thing to ask of them. I think there's room for many types, and there are many tastes in reading to be satisfied.
You know, I would agree with that. As somebody who kind of works underneath that science communication umbrella, I think sometimes there's too much pressure on scientists to also be, you know, journalists or storytellers. Now, I do think that it's good for scientists to understand that the public should be privy to good scientific work, and that the better you are at sharing what the science is that you do, the more likely you are to be funded, the more likely you are to have people promoting your work. But at the same time, some people shouldn't be asked to be storytellers because
Absolutely.
It's not really their strong suit.
It's not what they do best. And and when I worked at Cornell, that was my job, to write about what different scientists were doing, because the university felt that the publicity improved their chances of getting grants for scientific research.
And Cornell really got it, I think, in a lot of ways. They were ahead of the curve, probably because of Carl Sagan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But not every university caught on to that right away. And we're just now seeing many universities understanding how important it is to offer science communication courses or interviewing courses to their faculty and their graduate students, and how important it is that the public information officers are good at, you know, communicating what that science is that's happening within the university.
Yes. And at the time when Sagan was alive and was working, he took a lot of criticism for being, people accused him of being a self-promoter.
Yep.
Which was so unfair.
Yeah, I mean, it still happens to this day to people like Neil deGrasse Tyson. You know, they'll say, oh, he's not a real scientist. He's just a, you know, a TV scientist. And it's like, no, he, you know, he did and does lots of work. He, you know, runs the observatory at the museum, and he has many papers, and he has, you know, done a lot of very good science. But there is that kind of idea in people's minds that you can only be one or the other.
Right. And he has such a facility for speaking popularly and being mm-hmm. funny and being great with kids. I've seen him talk to children, and he's terrific.
Yeah. Did you have the opportunity to meet Carl Sagan?
Yes. Yes, I did. I met him and even got to work a little on Cosmos.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah.
That's very cool. I wasn't aware of that. Is that something, how far into your career were you during that experience?
I had already worked at Cornell, so I knew him. Mm-hmm. And when he was traveling with to make Cosmos, because the original was done on location in several countries, and they often had questions come up, people were curious about what they were doing, and he felt they needed a public relations person who understood the material but could also just field questions. Mm-hmm. And so that was my job, and it was very amorphous at the beginning. I wasn't really sure what I was doing, but it soon became clear. One day I remember we were in Greece. And there was a scene being filmed in an amphitheater. And so at the center, there was a fire pit that was supposed to represent the sun. And then mm-hmm. each of the ascending tiers of seats, there was a different flag. And the flags represented the planets. And I noticed that they had Saturn lower than Jupiter. And I was able to point that out before Sagan arrived on the set, which was a good thing because that would have ruined everybody's day. So that was a moment when I felt I knew what I was doing there. But often it was just helping with whatever needed to be done.
That's so great. What a fascinating aspect to your kind of wonderful and varied career. Do you feel like you've been lucky to have been so active during, in many ways, what I would think of as, I don't know, a height of scientific curiosity and exploration in this country?
Yes, I feel extremely lucky. And I remember when all the science magazines suddenly appeared in the late 1970s, all of a sudden, there were four, I'm trying to remember now what they all were, but Science 80, and we had Science Digest and Omni, mm-hmm. and I'm not going to remember now, but it went from almost nothing to quite an assortment, and they didn't last because, mm-hmm. and I felt from the beginning, if science is that interesting, then why isn't it just in the newspaper every day or in Time and Newsweek? Of course, it was, and now it's more so.
It is, you know, but it's interesting because I've been doing this, working in science communication, maybe the last 7 years. I'm in my early 30s now, and I do find that many people who are at this stage, and you know, some of my peers who are at this stage in our careers, sometimes we're having to fight back against some frustration and some cynicism because there is what we feel is a growing sort of anti-science sentiment in the public. So oftentimes wanting to just celebrate pure science or tell interesting scientific stories is met with a highly sort of politicized backlash, you know, when we talk about certain topics.
Yes, I do see that, and mm-hmm. it scares me a lot. Mm-hmm. And I apologize if I sounded insensitive to that, because I'm not doing so much. I'm not doing any really freelance writing anymore. So I haven't had to fight that fight, or I haven't been open to the reaction to it that you describe. But I do see that. And I, of course, the shrinking of the science coverage, many, many newspapers that had their own science sections have had to cut back because the whole nature of publishing is changing.
It's true. You know, a lot of science desks have closed, and even publishing houses. You know, there's a publisher that I've worked with in the past in bouncing around ideas about a book. I'm not quite there yet. But I remember reaching out to him once with an idea and saying, hey, you know, it's been a while since we've chatted, blah, blah, blah. Let's catch up. And he's like, oh, they closed the science imprint. So I'm now moving on to this other area. And I was like, oh, no. But that is kind of happening left and right, isn't it? Have you found that, you know, with this book especially, or with some of your more recent work, that it's been more difficult? Or have you had, you know, a pretty good track record, so that's allowed you to continue to do the work that you want to do?
I think that's what happened. When I wrote the proposal for this book, I was coming to a new subject from the other books, so I didn't have to shout as loudly. And again, I haven't been working on anything else, so I haven't had the experience of trying to convince an editor to take an idea and have it rejected or cut down from a feature story to a mention or a blog.
Sure. Yeah. And I do see that with many of my friends. You know, maybe I shouldn't say I'm lucky enough, but I'm not a big writer. I don't write often. Most of what I do is on air, so in television and then broadcast. But I do have many, many, many science writer friends. And it's definitely disheartening listening to some of the stories that they tell about trying to get features going, or if they do get offered a feature, not having enough money to travel and do the reporting appropriately. You know, it's difficult. The landscape is difficult, but I do sometimes see things that are hopeful. I see areas where it bounces back, and I see that, you know, publications like Scientific American, it's the longest running magazine in the country, and it's a science magazine, and it's still going very strong, and that brings me a lot of hope.
I've been a subscriber since I was in high school. Is it the oldest magazine in the country?
Yeah, isn't that funny? It's the longest running periodical, and it's a science magazine, which I just love that. I love that little tidbit. I read it all the time, and it when I get to read good science reporting and when I get to read good science books like yours, it does re-energize me. Because it reminds me that people are still reading this and people are still so excited about it. And we're learning from the past and we're learning from history so that we can build a better future. And the women in the Glass Universe were really fundamental to that. They laid the foundation for many more women and men to be able to continue and make these astronomical observations that, you know, we still use some of these techniques today, don't we?
Yes.
That to me is so crazy. That kind of in a pre-computer era, some of the techniques that were used are still fundamental to how we do astronomy.
Yeah, and the plates are still being used. In fact, they're being digitized now because the content was never fully mined. You had people looking at them as carefully as possible. But if you're looking at a plate that might have 50,000 stars on it, you know, there's only so much you can see and write down. Mm-hmm. So the digitization project has been underway for 10 years now. And I think it's only about a third of the way through. And part of the value of it is having the plates online so people don't have to travel to look at them or handle them, because of course they're fragile. Mm-hmm. And the other advantage is that people can check back if a new object is discovered. It's possible to go back in time through the plates and see if you can find evidence of it in the past.
That's true, because we know exactly when those were first recorded. We can make calculations about...
Every plate has the time it would take and the date, the place, the instrument, the exposure.
That's so cool. And it allows for this sort of open source, open access, even potentially citizen science component.
Yes, there is citizen science, because the logbooks that match the plates, those are being digitized, and that's on a crowdsourcing platform through the Smithsonian Institution. So people can volunteer to be the ones to key that in.
I love that. It goes full circle in many ways, back to allowing, you know, people who are just fundamentally interested to be able to contribute without having to have formal education and without having to have dedicated, you know, 30 years of their life to training in astronomy. You can still make a difference.
Yes.
I love that. Well, Deva, I've been taking up so much of your time today. I appreciate so much you sitting down. I was hoping that I could close this conversation by asking you the same two questions that I ask all of my guests when I have them on the show. And just fair warning, they're a little bit big picture, but I would be fascinated to hear your responses.
I'll try.
All righty. So the questions are, when you think about the future in whatever context, you know, matters to you, whether it's your own personal future, the future of your family or your community, or kind of the future of the planet and humanity as a whole, number one, what is the thing that kind of keeps you up the most at night, that concerns you and worries you the most? And number two, sort of so that we end on a higher note, what are you most hopeful and excited for?
Well, given the recent election results, I'm pretty scared. Mm-hmm. I think the climate situation is a major threat to life as we know it. I have children. I fear for their future. Mm-hmm. I really want to believe that the world will wake up and realize that unlimited growth is really not the way to keep going, and that we need to roll back and leave areas, as E.O. Wilson urges, just try to leave half the planet alone to help the Earth. I mean, the Earth will be fine without us, but we will not last long unless we face the climate threat.
Absolutely agree. Absolutely. I think that was very well put, and I think that it mirrors the fears of many of my guests on the show and many of the people listening. Is there anything that you are excited about or hopeful for, or kind of have?
Yeah, I am hopeful. I think young people are very inventive and creative, and I think if enough of them get it and put their minds to it, we'll see the necessary changes.
I agree with that as well. You know, sometimes it's easy to become cynical, or it's easy to kind of bemoan, especially like you said, in light of the recent election, it's easy to kind of fall into a pit. But I think when you shake yourself out of it and you really do open your eyes to everything that's happening around you, you can't ignore the incredible technological advancements, the ingenuity of individuals to solve major problems. And we just have to hope that the kind of moral arrow remains so that we're solving the right problems and with the right urgency. And every time I see, you know, a science fair at an elementary school, I have so much hope, because the types of problems that these children are trying to solve and the way that they do it is just genius. And it does quell some of my concerns.
Oh, good. I want to go with you.
It's so fun. Oh, yes. Judging a science fair is, I think, one of the most wonderful things I've ever done. It's great fun.
Oh, how great. Yeah.
Well, Deva, thank you so much. I had such a wonderful time chatting with you. I want to make sure everybody knows that The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars, is going to be available everywhere on December 6th. Is that right?
That's right.
And you'll be touring here in a while to promote the book.
Yes. We're going to launch the book at the Harvard Observatory. I'm very excited about it.
I love that. And so, of course, you can learn a lot about Deva at her website, devasobel.com. Are you active on social media at all?
I was brought in kicking and screaming to Facebook recently. So I'm a little bit active. I wouldn't say I'm active, but I'm liking it. I do like it. I do hear directly from people sometimes through that route, and I write back. I like that.
That's wonderful.
I'm not a complete dinosaur.
Well, guys, if you pick up the book, which I know you will, and you want to drop a line to Deva, you can say hi on Facebook and you can tell her how much you loved it. I'm really excited that you put all of this effort into this project, because I think it's something that will inspire a whole generation of young scientists to look to the past and know that they'll be standing on the shoulders of giants. And I think that you've offered that in wonderful narrative form to a lot of new readers. So thank you for that.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much.
And everybody listening, I want to thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.